VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. I'm Will Kelleher and you're listening to our special series examining just what it takes to win the Rugby World Cup in the company of those who have been there and done it. We'll take you from 1987 to 2019 through the eyes of great world champions ahead of the 10th World Cup in France this autumn. We'll hear their memories and stories, anecdotes and insight, all with the goal of answering one simple but devilish question. How do you win the World Cup? So join us on a rugby journey to whet your appetite for France with Legends of the Game. This time on How to Win the World Cup, we finish our series with the current world champion South Africa and their victory 4 years ago. 2019 sees the UK entangle itself over Brexit, Ed Sheeran and Ariana Grande wrestle in the music charts, and England win the Cricket World Cup by the barest of margins. South Africa have spent time between World Cups soul-searching. Some of their worst years of results lead to the sacking of head coach Alistair Coetzee. And so in comes Razzie Erasmus and everything changes. Back come the steamrolling South Africans who focus on their forward power and go from wounded Springboks to world champions in the space of 26 tests. Their third world title comes after an epic savaging of England up front as Makazole Mapimpi and Cheslin Kolbe dazzle out wide and Siya Kolisi becomes the first black captain to lift a World Cup. Part of the fabled bomb squad was Francois Loh, one of the few who are no longer in the South African team for this World Cup. So, from The Times and The Sunday Times, this is a Ruck special, How to Win the World Cup with Francois Loh. OK, Francois, awesome to have you rounding off our special Ruck series. And we always start with the easiest question of all on this pod series. For the final time, Francois Loh, how do you win the World Cup?
Very good question. Thank you very much for having me, guys. Nice to be here. Yeah, that is a very good question. How do you win the World Cup? Worked very hard for a very long time. Third time lucky in my case. 2011, not so good in the quarters. 2015, out in the semis. And then finally, 2019, managed to get a final crack at it. A lot of things had to align itself. Players, fitness, injury, and a wonderful venue in Japan itself. And all those things coming together, a little bit of brilliance from a few individuals, and I suppose there you have it.
Well, we'll try and find a definitive answer by the end of the show, but why don't we lay some context? And you mentioned 2015 there, and I suppose that's possibly where this journey starts for a lot of you. Obviously, you made the semi-finals of that World Cup, but that Japan defeat had to be laid to rest in the whole next cycle, I suppose, did it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, going back to 2015, super disappointed with that fixture, huge lessons learned. Rugby sort of works in four-year cycles, World Cup to World Cup, and often there's an exodus of players, senior players, potentially a rejig of coaches, a new head coach in the mix. 2016 and 2017 was probably the two darkest years in South African rugby in the professional era. The expectation from our side that we put on ourselves, that our supporters put on us, is sometimes not a question of winning, but winning by how much. You know, to have the string of results that we had in those 2 years, I think sort of mid-table in world rankings, which is, you know, really low for us, you know, generally knocking at the, you know, the top four, it was quite disappointing. You know, we had 24 months to, you know, to get back onto the horse. And as you mentioned, you know, there was a change of guard. Rassie coming in there with Jock Nienaber. Wouldn't say a complete overhaul, but a reset, finding out what has made us tick in the past and, you know, what are our strengths, you know, with the personnel that we have, what's our brand of rugby, you know, our identity, and ultimately finding alignment with that, you know, getting a complete buy-in across the board with players, management, and then gaining the respect and support back from, you know, from our people, from our nation.
So when Rassie did come in and sort of turning from 2017 into 2018, did he initially focus on that tactical side of the game and going back to the strengths of what BOC teams have been good at over the years? Or was it a wider thing than that? Was it to do with relationships between top and bottom in South African rugby or you as individual players? How did he kind of approach that first few months?
Yeah, I think it was exactly that, you know, recognizing what's made us tick in the past. You know, it's a very inherent style of play with South Africans. No secret, we're going to charge around the corner many times, let our biggest boys go first and the rest will follow. Try to stop that, and if we get into the right zone, we're going to send it wide and let the backs do their magic if they can. Otherwise, you know, we'll be in the air and there'll be an aerial battle all around. But, you know, rugby can sometimes be quite overcomplicated. It's everyone likes the idea of champagne rugby. We love seeing that. It's amazing to be involved in. Can't really claim I'd be involved in too many champagne moments. I'm generally down in dark places.
Some of the Bath teams, you threw it about a bit, 2015, George Ford and those guys.
Oh yeah, a little bit here and there. but you know, essentially stripping it back down to its basics and then getting a complete buy-in. As I mentioned earlier, alignment was sort of his buzzword, becoming aligned with, you know, what we're trying to achieve. There's no room for egos. It doesn't matter how many tests you've played, how few you've played, how long you've been in the mix from a management perspective. You know, we are a team and we're only as good as an outfit where everyone pulls together collectively. Very much a mindset shift. And then, you know, working on strategy, trying to create almost two teams that could replicate one another. Essentially, you know, that's where our second string, we'll call it second string, call it the bench, call it the bomb squad, as you know, often referred to, was this complete string of players that could come on, could just as easily have started. You know, from our side, we had a nice historic victory against New Zealand in Wellington, which was quite, you know, the catalyst, you know, to us, I suppose, regaining belief and, you know, actually realizing, you know, we've got this. If we can do this, if we do turn it on.
So I want to ask a bit more about the tactical bits and pieces, but on the off-field side of it, there was a lot of alignment, I suppose is the same word, with learning about each other's stories. And we've seen the Chasing the Sun documentary where a lot of it is about that. And, for example, Makazole Mapimpi and learning about his family situation. So was that a key part of it as well, is almost, whether you'd lost them or not, sort of bonding together as a group of men too, from different parts of the country and different backgrounds?
Absolutely. I think, especially in South Africa, we've obviously got a very diverse nation. Guys from different walks of life, different ethoses, outlooks, backgrounds. Quite exciting, really. You know, trying to find a way to park everything and come together as a collective, you know, as sort of a brotherhood, as a team, gel and trust one another. I mean, I have to be quite honest, you know, watching that Chasing the Sun, you know, you kind of look at the guy's stories, you're like, I don't know that. Mm. That is... wow, you know,
which was the one that shocked you the most of those guys?
Yeah, I think you know, you mentioned him, Mpimpi Makazole, Kanyo Am. At the end of the day, everyone's got a story. Some guys, their story is probably a bit harder than others in terms of adversity they may have faced. But it's all about perspective. You know, you can get someone who had a pretty decent upbringing and still have a pretty tough story. But a lot of these lads, you know, came from pretty much nothing. You know, I know Sia's story. I played with Sia, you know, since he was a young kid, and he got a great opportunity to attend an amazing school in South Africa, and got accelerated into, you know, into elite sport, really. Got that opportunity and utilized it completely. But some of the other blokes, you know, you just didn't know, and you kind of think like, wow, this guy was, I was training with him every day. You think you know someone. And I think a lot of guys were kind of just painting up all that all that emotion that they had, with their upbringing, their story, and trying to reframe that in some form of motivation for themselves. But after the World Cup, let the wall down, let the curtain drop, and we've done this, and this is actually my story, which was, I got goosebumps watching those guys speak, and I was like, wow, I just didn't know that. So inspiring.
So from viewers and listeners up this end of the world in England, I think we saw the box coming together for that series in 2018. And the most significant decision, I suppose, around that was making Sia Khaleesi captain. You mentioned him before. You played a lot of rugby with him. But can you put it into context from a South African side of just how significant that was, a decision for Razzie to make? Obviously, he was the right man for the job, but it came with much more than that for Sia.
Yeah, I suppose it did. From our side, it was irrelevant whether he was black or white.
Yeah.
It didn't really make a difference to us. He was a young flanker. Well, not young, he was 20, I think 25 or 6 at the time. Might be wrong there. But a young player coming through with, a lot more senior guys in the team. But he was the individual that Razzie chose, that Razzie asked to lead the side. And, thinking back on that, just from terms of a captaincy and leadership perspective, Sia is he's a very humble guy. And most importantly, as a leader, he's very self-aware. And he immediately understood the magnitude of the role of leading the Springbok team. I'm just putting the South Africa aside for now, in terms of leading the Springbok side to successful rugby, championship rugby, and ultimately, giving ourselves the best chance to win the World Cup. And what he very quickly did is he surrounded himself with the most influential and senior guys on the team in such a way that he said, look, I can't do this without your help. I need you to take care of certain departments, and he approached the top guys in the team who I wouldn't say they would have been bitter, but there's a few guys who could easily have been captain. It's a you're a group of alpha males who are experienced and put their hand up, and they'll take that role without a blink of an eye, but it ultimately has to go to one man. And what he did is he pulled that senior group of leaders together and empowered them, rather than potentially create a conflict between, big heads, big egos. He got those guys on his side. I remember having a good conversation with him in and around that. And he almost like disarmed any sort of like push and pull from others quite quickly to create, quite a strong leadership outfit, as his first sort of input as a captain. So, and he did it in style.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, while you were saying all that, I'm just thinking it's a fascinating thing, particularly for South Africans at World Cups, I suppose. And South Africa have won 3 as many as anyone else, because you have that ability to tap into things that are unique to South Africa about the political situation, about stuff that's not about the rugby. So for a South African at a World Cup, how do you balance that by... Because I imagine if you get too overly emotional with that, or connect too much to things that might drive you over the edge in a game, and don't think enough about the tactical side or just beating an opposition that have no relevance to all of that history and all that politics, it's the balance, isn't it? So where did you try and take that? Because I suppose you could get too into one side or the other, couldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that we spoke about regularly and tapped into. Going into these big games, there's a huge mental side to it, in any sport, maybe in any situation. And, ultimately you talk about pressure, and, those are the things that can derail you. You can prepare as well as you want. You can be ready, physically ready, strategically ready, you've done your homework. And then in the moment, the biggest moment, the pressure is just squeezing you. And, you can potentially have a wobble, which can derail a game, a campaign, a moment. We started digging down into, what is pressure? And, you might have heard the saying before that, pressure is a privilege. Playing in a World Cup final is not pressure. Waking up at 3:30 in the morning, trying to find a job to feed your family of 6, you got no cash in the bank, you got a sick grandmother in a house, you got people that you're afraid for your life. That's pressure. That's real pressure. what we've got is absolute privilege, you know, to be able to have that nervousness, your heart beating, you know, to perform well, you know, to impress your people, your supporters, and ultimately deliver. And that's that perspective that we try to create. And looking back at all the big moments in South Africa, you know, looking back at past World Cups, you know, John Smith leading the team in 2007, Francois Pienaar in 95, all those moments, you know, and compartmentalizing that and taking the positives out of that and, you're almost trying to, I suppose, predict what's going to happen next and how that situation may feel. You know, you almost kind of like mentally try and live it, but utilizing us, you know, I suppose as much as you can from, you know, from our history and the scenarios and the people and trying to kind of frame that. But then also still got to play rugby, so you still got to try and focus on all the different plays. The opposition and doing that.
Absolutely. We'll get onto some rugby in a second, but I'd love to ask you about being in Japan and the whole Japanese experience, because I was there as a journalist and we all just loved it. It was a brilliant, something completely different, somewhere that lots of us had never been before, but it was quite alien. It was different. It was weird in places. It was mad. That it was crazy. I remember the week of the final, I think you guys were staying at Disneyland, which must have been a bit strange, like Mickey Mouse and Goofy knocking about. Were you trying to think about beating England? But what was it like for players? I mean, you're focusing on games, but was it good fun as well?
What an experience. Wow. I mean, to go to a place like Japan, so foreign, so crazy. You know, we went to some places. You know, we got there early. We had about, you know, three or four liaisons with us, you know, translators, and some of the places, I mean, I don't think they'd seen Westerners before. You know, we're going to these schools to go see the kids, and they see guys like the Beast, and they think these are, and Achia Snaima, I think these are real life giants. Like the kids are literally running up to them, like touching them, like feeling them, like pulling their beards. It's like, which was, it was just so crazy to see. The food was so foreign, the people so different, but so hospitable. I mean, we were so welcome there, and maybe it's got something to do with the Japanese beating us in 2015. I don't know. You know, nice little side story. Quite a humorous bunch, actually. So when you get to a hotel as a squad, you know, you arrive, it's frantic, loads of luggage, bags, and you, there's a table nicely set out with envelopes on and your name on and your room keys in there, and there's a room list, and there's the physio room, the eating, you know, whatever. Here's the Wi-Fi code. Yes, everyone wants Wi-Fi. And so they got the Wi-Fi codes. They got three Wi-Fi connections to make, one on each floor. And here are the Wi-Fi codes, and the Wi-Fi codes are Brighton 1, Brighton 2, and Brighton 3. So, well done. Gotta love the Japanese humor. You know, all the elevators had newly installed TVs in them. You know, so you can watch a bit of TV while you have your, you know, 20-second ride up, and they just basically had the Brighton game on replay. all the tries. No, none of our tries, by the way, just the Japanese tries.
Goromaru, so, Hesketh,
which was good. I mean, you know, what a wonderful place, you know, going all over the island, all over Japan, you know, a lot of sights, a lot of tourist things, you know, seeing how the guys make samurai swords, like, you know, their culture, their food, having our liaisons with us just to try and figure out. I mean, you got the menu out, and it's like full on Japanese. You're like, just whatever you think we should have. And they're like, and they're buying it to you.
Don't
just
get
so much respect.
Intestines.
And then you get all kinds of strange things. But I mean, what an experience. Like, I couldn't have asked for anything more, you know, as a human.
I'd love to know about the psychology then of playing them in the quarterfinal. Like, you'd put to bed 2015 maybe in the warm-up game beforehand, going over there and making a point of beating them. At this point, Japan have shocked Scotland, they've shocked Ireland. So actually you coming second in your pool maybe has opened up the draw a bit differently to how you expected, but everyone's loving Japan. They would love to see a repeat, everyone who's neutral anyway. You're in their home country and you've got to go and ruin the party, basically, beat them. I remember when you did, there's a journalist who now works for the Times, Martin Samuel, who was at another paper before, and I think his introduction to the thing was, South Africa have just killed Bambi. Was there a sense of, we're going to have to ruin the party here by beating them?
Well, I tell you what, as I said, I think there was a sort of a nice link with it after 2015. You know, the Japanese very much favoured us. I think we were almost, or it felt like it at least at times, we were their second team.
Okay.
Until that quarterfinal week. Japanese are the most precise people on this earth. Mm. I mean, the bullet train leaves at like 23 seconds past half past 12. It's on the second. Like, nothing is ever late. It's perfection. I mean, I think they didn't even wobble. Come the quarterfinal, suddenly those floodlights aren't working at the evening training sessions. The bus is half an hour late to take us to training. It's almost like they were like, okay,
oh, sorry, sir.
You guys aren't our team anymore. That's great. Rightly so. But yeah, going into that game, I mean, it was still a big game. Obviously, you know, we played them that warm up game. You know, we had one over them, but it's knockout rugby, and you know, the team of awesome individuals, you know, amazing players. We had a precarious moment in that quarterfinal, and if you recall, but the Beast accidentally did a spear tackle on a player.
Yeah.
And I mean, we spoke about, you know, all the way leading up to the World Cup, like, it's discipline. World Cups are won on penalties. When it comes to playoff rugby, you make a mistake, all the kickers are on form. They're going to be blasting balls over from anywhere on the pitch. You can't give away penalties. Yellow card, let alone, you know, red card, that's game over. And, I mean, you could see the remorse in the man's face, like that image of him sitting on the ground, like, you know, hands in the air, just apologizing, got the yellow card. We sitting there like, oh, no, this is not happening. Like, this could be it. But, you know, on top of that, we pushed through. We played our same game. We were quite strict with playing exactly the same game, regardless of opposition, whether it was Canada or Namibia, Italy, New Zealand, or, you know, now Japan in the quarterfinals. So tough game nonetheless, but we were ready for it. And, you know, the focus was there and then. And whoever we play in the semis, that'll be the next opposition that we need to knock over.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you if people send you the same generic conversation starters they message everyone else? Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I don't want to gloss over your glorious turnover in the semi-final that was the last penalty against Wales, but I'd love to do as much as we can on the final and winning it and everything else, so I don't want to keep you forever. But so let's get to the final then. So England have beaten New Zealand, and certainly from the English perspective, everyone suddenly starts going, oh, wow, here we go. Didn't expect it to get to the final, but they've just beaten the All Blacks, who've won back-to-back World Cups. But from your perspective, obviously your game was the Sunday after they'd played, wasn't it? So you didn't know that you were going to go through. But once you had won, you're a guy who's played in England, you know some of the English guys in the team. Did you quietly sit there and think, they've played their final already, we've got them here?
No, not at all. It was all very much about what's next, next job. Our next job was on Wales. Didn't really matter who was in the final. We'd have to try and beat them to get ultimate glory. You know, there wasn't even time to think about that. Like, the semis is as big as a final. You know, it is a final match. You're out. If you lose that, you're out. Wales were a solid outfit in 2019. Can definitely match the Springboks, you know, blow for blow. Take them down to the gutters and they'll run around there with you. You know, they're a tough team, and, you know, historically it's a team that we've lost against quite a few times. But the focus was all about Wales. The focus on England literally came after that final whistle blew against Wales. I mean, I know the analysts were really cutting England's game as soon as they'd finished, you know, preparing for them. But it wasn't so much a point of us thinking they've played their final, because maybe they hadn't. Maybe more was to come. You know, so it'd be very complacent and I think silly to think of it like that. You know, that was quite an awesome team. in 2019. They want to turn it up, they can. And there's no reason why they couldn't have turned it up back to back. They obviously didn't at the time, but it was never a case of thinking, oh, well, they played a little bit too well. In fact, it was probably the other. It's probably, I mean, we could have, you know, it was more a case of thinking, well, how much confidence and momentum are they going to take by knocking the All Blacks off their pedestal in a semi-final going into the final? I mean, I think that was maybe a little bit more realistic, where we had like, well, actually, these guys are going to be really angry now. They know they can do it. New Zealand beat us, and they beat them pretty comfortably. They've got the people to do the job. They've got the players, the tactics. Why couldn't they do it again? You know, that was so. It's like, you know, our prep starts right now. It was like final mode. Bang! We got to get this on. We got to understand every single one of their players, how they play, their tact, their strat. You know, what are they doing? And focus on what we can do and how we can, you know, take them on.
Yeah. So talk to me about final mode and getting into that mindset. Is it a lot of tactics? You've got, what, 6-day turnaround to a World Cup final? And is it a study in Curry and Underhill for you and things like that? Or is there a lot of it that's actually like, look, we know what we're doing, we know the game plan, and it's then emotional buttons being pushed and things like that? How does it actually work through the week for a player in a World Cup final?
You're not going to become better. You're not going to like change much. You know, we're creatures of habit. There's a lot of routine. You still go do weights in the week. I mean, you're not going to get stronger. You're not going to get fitter, but you still have a little blowout, a nice sweat out, you know, on the odd day. You know, you've been doing that literally for 4 or 5 months. Like, it's the same process. And like, dare you stop, you're actually upsetting the whole process, you know. So it was very routine driven. It wasn't like, okay, guys, you know, we've done the work. You know, go sit in your room and think about how badly you want this. I mean, that's... wasn't going to do anything. It was still a full week, simulated across all previous weeks. We still reviewed our Wales game. Okay, here we sharpen up. Okay, you were a bit slow here, around here. Okay, you're going to push up here. You can always refine. And then ultimately looking at, you know, the small little tweaks. You know, you got your basic blueprint, your strategy of how we play. I mean, we had 3 or 4 players in the final. 1, 2, 3, 4, and when you get to 4, you start again. 1, 2, 3, 4. It's really uncomplicated. Like, that doesn't matter where you are. Those are the strike plays, whatever happens. I mean, we just want to get in on the front foot, get into general attack, and then that's how we roll. You know, so very simple in that regard. But it was very much making sure that you understand your role. I mean, I think the biggest fear, at least for myself, was being the one who didn't execute their job on the day. But then obviously there's the mental side, and you tap into whatever you need to get motivation from. I mean, obviously there's the country, the people, there's your family, there's your sacrifice. I mean, I didn't see my kids I saw them twice in 5 months.
Wow.
You know, I was coming on to week 9 without seeing my family. You know, those are the people that really sacrifice, you know. And then ultimately, you know, looking each other in the eye and saying, well, you know, how badly do we want this? How badly do we want to win and dominate? You know, how badly do we want to be world champions? You know, what does that look like? And also at risk of not being over-motivated and being blinded by, you know, the task ahead. You know, you still got to play rugby. You got to play rugby for 80 minutes.
So if we spool onto the game, you came on 63rd minute, and I think it was 15-12 at that point, so right in the balance. But quite quickly afterwards, bang, bang, Mapimpi, Colby, 2 tries. So was that the moment where you thought, we're going to do this? Or had you sensed it coming when you were watching off the bench, where you thought, I know it's tight, but we're going to win this game, we've got it?
No, it was never like that. We know how quickly games can change. You know, I spoke about it earlier. You know, you look how games are won and lost. You can lose by 15 points, but you might have only lost 3 minutes in a match. Just those 3 minutes, the other team had the upper hand on you. You know, I think in that All Black game, you know, we had like 6.5 minutes where they absolutely dominated us, and that's where they, you know, scored their tries. You know, and we looked at it in that perspective. So it was a point of playing 80-minute rugby, you know, play to that final whistle. So cliche, but so important. And that's exactly what it boils down to. You know, as a member of the squad coming off the bench, you either got to make one hell of a difference to win a game, or you're going to make one hell of a difference to keep the lead. You know, it's never like a clean run through to the end. So, you know, coming on, it's super tight. It's one error. You might just slip. You might drop a ball. You might do something stupid. Who knows what can happen? So it was pretty much, you know, you've got to play to the end. So it was never a case of thinking, oh, we've got this. We've got the end. You know, there was one moment where I realized we had it. I think we packed down for a scrum. There were about 3 minutes left or 4 minutes left. And I packed down. I see Billy, his white shirt all red. You know, he's taken a few shots in that game. We look at each other, obviously play against one another a lot. And the on-pitch camera pans across. So that's on the big screen, pans across to the engraver engraving our name on the trophy before the game's over.
Wow.
I kid you not, which was like, that's weird. Like, I'm very excited, but I'm not showing emotion. And you can see the England boys are looking up and it's like, you know, they're still keeping their straight faces. And we're like, what's, you know, this is it. And then, you know, hanging on for the last little bit. So kind of celebrating inside, but just not just yet. You know, we still we still want to finish strong and super pumped up. I mean, yeah, obviously just witnessing Cheslin's try. You know, that was pure brilliance from an individual, and that ultimately sealed it. I mean, there wasn't really a chance that they would come back from that. But you know, but still just in that process, that mindset, the machine mindset. We've got to play to the final whistle. It's not over till it's over.
It was the second biggest margin of victory, I think, in a World Cup final, 20 points. So it must have been a challenge, I think, to stay in that mindset, knowing everyone else, I think, with about 10, 15 minutes to go, was just like, there's just no way. England are done here. South Africa are champions. You got the bloke engraving the trophy already. Must have been a weird, I suppose, for other World Cup wins, there's been like a great last minute moment, or a Johnny drop goal, or a Joel Stransky in extra time, or something like that, or it's tight the whole way and you just sneak over the line. But was there a period for you where it kind of dribbled in over the last 5 minutes or so, or was it still that kind of final whistle goes and it all comes out and the emotion and you finally realise you've done it?
Yeah, it was kind of like when we saw Mampimpi's try and Chislin's try. It's almost like that gave us like an extra kick. I realize I'm just sprinting to the scrum, sprinting to the lineouts for the next drill, sprinting to get into position for the next restart. It was almost like this energy just pumping and pushing through. But maybe that was, you know, a form of like elation, knowing that, you know, this is, we're going to do this. We're going to get this. We're going to finally achieve the absolute highest accolade in our game that we love so much. You know, maybe slightly more emotional for me than any other game, not just that it's a final, but the fact that it is my last game for South Africa. You know, that was always knew it would be my last, you know, so to have it in a final, to have it pan out the way that it did, you know, to become a world champion, it's like, I don't have words for it right now.
So yeah, so after it's all over and you've won the trophy, what do you remember about the party? Do you go straight home? Is there a big night out in Japan, or is it all straight back on the jumbo jet back to Joburg? How did it all pan out after the final?
No, there was definitely an all-nighter, celebrations all round.
Faf de Klerk and his budgies, yeah. We all saw that. That was too much, I think.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I think, you know, that was fairly tame to what actually went on.
I'll
leave that to the imagination. But, you know, going back to the hotel, you know, we had a policy that family could come with you the whole tournament, you know, stay with you in your rooms. There were kids there. There were wives and partners there. You know, it was very much a community-driven environment. We had basically the whole floor booked out at the Hilton Hotel in Disneyland. Unbelievable scenes.
Did you get a visit from anyone special? Mickey or Goofy or someone? Donald Duck?
Fortunately, there was strict security at the door. Okay, there was none good of that. But you know, just all-nighter, really. You know, we obviously had the awards a night or two later, the World Rugby Awards. Then I actually came straight back to England. I was the only one who didn't fly straight back to Africa. I just, you know, said to the guys, like, I need to go see my family.
And play a bit of Prem Rugby. Why not? Bristol away or something?
No rugby. Just a boozy 2 day with the family, lots of hugs, and then straight back on a jet to South Africa 2 days later to go join the festivities of a 5 day open bus tour.
Wow.
All over South Africa, 5 cities, 5 days, 5 flights, banquet dinners. I mean, and to experience the joy and elation and support and congratulations from the South African people, which man, that's pretty much right up there with being on the field, you know, holding that golden trophy.
Yeah. So what's the hangover like after 5 days in 5 different cities and about 500 pints? that's one of the biggest hangovers ever.
Jeez. Yes. Luckily, we had the team doc with us, okay. And he took care of us quite nicely.
Rehydration,
you know. Very, very well hydrated. I mean, like, look, the high stayed with us for so long. I mean, yeah, that was the smallest part of the worry. You know, you get back here and then it's celebrating with friends and family back in the UK as well. But wild party, I have to say. Yeah, definitely one that I relive on my phone quite a bit with all the videos and photos, which is not for the public.
No, definitely not. No. So last question before we wrap up, Francois. And we're 4 years on, obviously, and the Boxers are going back to the World Cup. You're one of the few people that aren't still in the squad because, as you say, that was your last game in a Box jersey. 4 years on, and maybe at the time too, do you think the Box got the respect they deserve for winning that tournament? Because whenever people talked about it then and maybe still now, there's the whole sort of, oh, well, all they did was beat people up and that sort of thing, which is really reductive. But do you still think that no one has quite given the Box credit for how low you were in 2016-17 and how high you became in 19?
Well, you know, Will, it's very tough at the top. You're always going to get people that are going to try and pull you down, but that's okay. I think we get the respect from from the people that it matters most. You know, at the end of the day, we got a World Cup in the trophy cabinet with medals around our necks, and no one's going to remember how anyone did it. Perhaps you, when you're a sports journalist, you'll know how the teams exactly how they played. But you know, we'll take it any way that it comes. You know, I think it's been a strange 4 years. You know, with a pandemic settling in, you know, cutting our moment quite short, which is quite sad from a South African perspective. You know, I don't think we were able to ride that wave, you know, from a hope perspective within our country as much as we should have or could have. But nonetheless, it's a new era.
So right, the last question we've got. The blueprint. How do you win the World Cup? Come on. What's the secret? I've written a few things down. We've got playing on the motions, learning from previous failures, finding your identity, decluttering, alignment, belief. What's your couple of words that you'd use, Francois, to sum it all up?
All of the above. And look, I think ultimately there's like an inherent desire in a person. You know, how badly you want something. And it's not to say that you know, the teams that didn't win it wanted it any less than we did. But all I can attest for is the experiences that we had. And there was going through those playoffs, especially going to the final. There was no ways that we were going to lose that final match. You know, there's quite an iconic moment for me, at least. You know, where the two teams are standing in the tunnel just before they run out. They've got the trophy in the middle of them this year. Standing there, behind him is the beast, Bongi Mnumbi. You know, the rest of the team turned round. And then the other side, you've got Owen Farrell. I think Johnny May was at the front, George Ford. And it's quite a cool shot. There's a little video of them before they run out. And at not one stage did any South African rugby player look left to look at any of the England players. You can see the determination in their eyes. And you see other guys, you know, moving side to side. And you see Owen looking right, you see Johnny May looking right, you see George Ford looking at the opposition, checking them out, you know, just sizing them up. And it was that inherent and, I suppose, long-standing desire that, you know, we were going to do whatever it takes to win. There's no ways we're leaving this field, you know, without the glory and not being victors in that moment. So I suppose that's not my few words. That's a lot of words, but I think that was very much part of the recipe.
Well, there you go. Brilliant. Thanks so much, Francois. And you've helped us perfectly wrap up our series of how to win the World Cup. And it's been an absolute pleasure to hear your memories of yours in 2019. So all the best for this one for the Box.
Well, thanks a lot, guys. Really appreciate it. Nice to be on the show.
And there you go, Francois Lowe rounding off our special series. And for him, it was all about desire. We hope you've enjoyed this look back from 1987 to 2019 in the company of the greats. As ever, like and subscribe, share the pods, follow at Time Sport on social media, and most of all, enjoy the rugby.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.